Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, July 5th, 1996. In the fireside room this morning, our speaker is Chad Myers. Today's session number is 5 and is titled Jesus, Presence in the Storm, Questioner of Our Answers. Let's listen in.
On the circle, and since now you know all the movements, right? Like this, don't burn yourself now. Maybe we'll get some help on that. You could even close your eyes and do it, kind of, because you can hear it coming around at you. Ooh, cool. All right. Why don't we, thank you. Candle is lit. Camp meeting is on. Let's be real soft. A beautiful day in Holden Village. Roll 'em, posse. Name, Myers. Title of the session, Way Too Long. What is the title of the session? 9 o'clock session. It's another boat story, let's put it that way. Thanks for coming, thanks for being here. Any folks new to the process this morning? Well, welcome, just in time for the benediction. Glad you're all here, and let me again express my gratitude for this week, my first week, first time up here. I've really enjoyed working with you, sitting around the campfire together, telling stories. It's been a real enjoyment for me, and particularly all of you, y'all's receptivity and friendliness and willingness to engage this material. Thanks, hope I see you up here again sometime. Those of you, this is a plug that was requested by the bookstore. If you're interested in catching some of these books, they're listed here. The publisher of all three is down. Let me just make a note that the first one, Binding the Strong Man, which is the big commentary on Mark, there will be a popular version, a smaller version, coming out at this fall, also available through Orbis, and you could put in an order for that now. That's much more appropriate, really, for church study groups and adult Sunday school, that kind of thing. And bookstore is anxious to take your orders. That is Holden Bookstore, and I believe they're going to try to send out an order today. So if you want to put your name in the pot, please do so, because then, is it Frank, the bookstore?
John.
As John said, then Holden gets a cut. So it's a good thing somebody gets a cut. So support your Holden Bookstore. Let's have a quick resume of some of the water stories that we've read this week for folks who are just getting on board, so to speak. The Red Sea story, the beginning of the Exodus story, through the waters. At least half the folks got through the waters.
Jonah story.
The Jonah story. The story of the reluctant prophet who wanted to cry out, was ordered to cry out against the great city of Nineveh, and instead hightailed it in the opposite direction and therefore had to go under the waters to learn a lesson in the belly of the beast, about the belly of the beast. What else?
Noah and the flood.
Yeah, don't forget old Noah. I don't see how you possibly could forget Noah after that great float yesterday. Float being, of course, a double entendre. It's kind of nice. There was Neptune. Who else was there? Unreal. It's great. Not at all. I was looking for the seaweed almost. And forgetting one because it's the least known of the four. That's right. The probably the least known of those four, which is the other bookend of the Exodus story in which Israel comes around through the back door, comes into Canaan to begin the liberation struggle and crosses the River Jordan at Gilgal and sets up 12 stones symbolizing the new body politic of Israel, and the ark leads the people through the Jordan on dry ground. We saw in the middle of the week how the baptism of Jesus himself seems to allude or invoke these stories. He is baptized in the River Jordan, right at the site of beginnings. He goes under the water, just like Jonah. He goes on a vision quest to retrace the footsteps of his ancestors, to try to find out where they went wrong and how to heal his people. Right after baptism, he's off, goes to the hike house, gets his backpack, he's off into the wilderness for 40 days, again going back to the point of origins, invoking both Noah's flood and the Exodus wanderings. And Jesus, of all people he could have picked to do an apprenticeship with, comes to John the Baptist, who is in a very real way a kind of a Jonah figure, that is, the later Jonah, the one who gets it right, who dares to preach repentance. And in yesterday's story of the journey across the Sea of Galilee, we saw some allusions again to the Jonah story in particular. What were they? Anybody remember?
Maybe the boat, back of the boat sleeping.
Yeah, Jesus is asleep in the back of the boat, just like Jonah was.
Big storm.
Big storm blows up and everybody in the boat thinks they're going down. That's right. They're going somewhere they don't want to go. That is, they are going to the other side. Here's your pocket map again of Jordan and the Sea of Galilee. They're going across to the Decapolis, which we saw in first century Palestine was considered enemy territory. Well, we've arrived at the second boat story. And let us read that. Mark chapter 6, beginning in verse 45. We will read down through 52. And if you wouldn't mind beginning us, and we'll... No, you know what? I've got to give the balcony a chance up there. I know y'all don't even have enough light to read up there, so we'll see how you do. You want to start us off? Mark 6, 45 to 52. Let us hear the word of God.
Immediately, he made his disciples get into the boat and go on ahead to the other side, to Bethsaida, while he dismissed the crowd.
After leaving them, he went up on a mountainside to pray.
Verse 47.
When evening came, the boat was out on the sea, and he was alone on the land. When he saw that they were straining at the oars against an adverse wind, he came towards them early in the morning, walking on the sea. He intended to pass them by.
But when they saw him walking on the lake, they thought he was a ghost. They cried out. For they all saw him and were terrified. But immediately he spoke to them and said, "Take heart, it is I. Do not be afraid."
Then he got into the boat with them, and the wind ceased, and they were utterly astounded.
For they did not understand about the loaves, but their hearts were hardened.
All right. How many of you are teachers? Let's talk for a minute about teachers and students. In the process of learning and teaching, do you ever have an adversarial relationship with your students? Well, alrighty then. I guess that's yes. Do you ever have to send students out on their own? In other words, does there come a point in the process where there's a time to kind of be with them, and then there's a time to kind of send them out? Anybody want to just tell a story or two that comes to mind about that kind of a experience? Maybe an experience in which there's been a clear moment in which you realized that your student or students had to really take off on their own in order to learn. Anybody want to throw anything into the pot here? Come on, this is the second session, folks. I already made it through the first session. All right.
In the parent-related thing, where students get to do individual tutorials on topics that they want. And a student from Washington came to me one time and said she wanted to do something on habits of her heart. And so usually I just say, well, you know, here's some books we might read, and let's go at it. And I signed a book for her to read for the first week. She came in and was almost speechless about it, which is not a good thing, but it's just me and her. I'll be able to do better with another book next week, and I tried that again. And she came in the second week and was like nothing. And then, so she just couldn't figure out how to analyze this stuff that I was giving her, and it wasn't that hard. So I said, well, you know, what kinds of things are you thinking about? And it turned out she kept a journal. And I said, well, let's do this a different way. You show me what's in the journal, and I'll find you something academic that matches up with that. And after that, it was just transformed. She was on her own, and I was helping her out rather than being the director. And we took a tutorial that started out to be just one semester and went two semesters with it, just sort of following her journal, trying to clarify the thoughts that she had.
That's a nice example. And I want to reflect a little bit on these texts this morning as this is a kind of a school of the road or a school of the boat, as the case may be. I alluded yesterday to the fact that in this second boat story, Jesus has to literally force the disciples to get into the boat in order to cross over to the other side. I wonder why. Those of you who were in yesterday's session, why might that be? Yes. Oh, you're waving at someone. Why are the disciples so reluctant to get in the boat? First of all, they don't like where they're going.
They had trouble last time.
Secondly, they don't like how difficult it was to get there.
You know, there's a headwind.
Yeah, it's starting to dawn on them that this journey takes you right into the headwinds of hell. Notice the spatial distance in the first two verses of this story. Jesus dispatches them on their own after, you know, taking roll call to make sure everybody's in the boat, no doubt. And he goes up on the mountain to pray. In the next verse, there is this poignant portrait. I think it's poignant. Verse 47, evening comes. The boat is out on the sea, and Jesus is alone on the land. It just couldn't be more distant. Ever felt like that? This is now a reiteration of the first boat story. The metaphor of distance between the disciples and Jesus in the first story was what? Jesus was snoring away like Cliff in a seminar. Sawing logs, and they're, you know, ready to cash in their chips going down in this storm. In this case, Jesus is not even in the boat. He's way apart on land. And here they are, out alone on the sea. And verse 48, he saw that they were straining at the oars against an adverse wind. Literally, in the Greek, they were tortured against the oars. Rowing into the wind, no doubt losing ground. Have you ever felt like that?
Yeah.
Have you ever felt like that?
Amen.
Have you as a church ever felt like that?
Yes.
Because if you haven't, you're not paying attention. In the history that we're in, friends, if it doesn't feel like we're rowing into a headwind and losing ground, then maybe it's because we've decided to stay in the safe harbors and not even venture out. Because believe me, the winds out there are strong. This is a tough moment. Again, no wonder they didn't want to go. And then comes the epiphany. What an epiphany. Jesus walks right by them. I feel an old R&B song coming on. Nah, just kidding. He walks on by. For those of you who didn't get it the first time. And he sees that they're in great distress. And now comes a kind of an interesting moment. They saw him, and they thought it was a ghost. This is a play on words in the Greek. It's a play on the word phantasm, which means can mean to see a vision or to see a ghost. That's familiar. We're not sure what we're seeing. But Jesus' words to them perhaps are the most poignant of all. He addresses himself to them in the same way that he did in the boat story, saying, addressing their fear, real fear, folks, real fear. The journey of faith is all about fear. Believe it. If you're not afraid, you're not paying attention. And here is Jesus saying, take heart. And then he identifies himself. And the words he uses, literally, are I am. Now, you know that that's the old story, don't you? Turn to Exodus 3. I keep trying to tell you there's only one story in this book. We've been working with a lot of water images this week because we're trying to figure out what in the world baptism means. And we know, saw from the preaching of John the Baptist on Wednesday, that wherever there's water, there's also fire. So if Jesus is revealing himself in the middle of a wet storm, so in the old story, God reveals himself to who? To Moses in the middle of a burning bush. Exodus 3. You know the context. Moses has seen the suffering of his people in Egypt. He's out minding his own business one day. Sees this bush going up in flames. Verse 3, wherever we left off, just read Exodus 3, beginning. let's say in verse 13, there's this conversation between Moses and the burning bush. It's a bad day for Moses. He's talking to a bush. Or worse, the bush is talking to him. And it's saying, I got a great plan. We're going to bust out of Egypt. You're the man. You're going to lead the people out. Moses gets over that, and he says, okay, fine, I'll take your word for it. That's what we'll do. He starts to go off to tell the people, and then he stops, and he says, who shall I say you are? Well, in other words, he's kind of asking for a card here so that he can have something to try to explain this to the people. So let's pick it up at verse 13. And read through verse 15.
Then Moses said to God, if I come to the people of Israel and say to them, the God of your ancestors has sent me to you, and they ask me, what is God's name? And what shall I say to them?
God said to Moses, I am who I am. And he said, say this to the people of Israel, I am has sent me to you.
This is my name forever. And it is the name of...
15.
Okay. This is my name forever, and it is the name that people must use from now on.
Keep going.
Yeah, that's fine. Literally, this is my name forever. Christians, listen up. This is God's name forever. This is God's name. It is an acronym. In the Hebrew, it means Yahweh. I am. Or, also in the future tense, I will be whoever I will be. Which is what we might call the divine slap in the face to Moses who wants to name God. It's God listening to Wes Preeb doing the dead and dying thing. I know who I am. You just go about this. You didn't realize there was a deep theological subtext to that. I know who I am. Your business is not to name me, to put me in a box, to... capture me with your theology, to domesticate me, to put me at the service of your historical projects. I am the radically free God who names myself, which is why I'm fixing to bust you out of Egypt. Because only a free God can free a people. Only a free God can free a people. This is my name forever and ever and ever and ever, and don't try to name me. Listen up, Christians. So when Jesus invokes those words in the middle of the storm, there's two things going on, I think, at least. One is he's going back to the roots of the tradition again. He's saying, this is what it's all about. This is God's name forever. And he's also perhaps saying something about the social location of divine revelation, as the theologians would say. You can try to find God in church. You can try to find God in your prayer closet. You can try to find God reading big, thick books. And maybe you'll find God, maybe you won't. But according to Mark's story, there is one place where you will surely find the God of history. And that is not in the safe havens. And not in the harbors where everybody looks like you. And not on the safe shores where business as usual can continue. You will find God most assuredly when you are in the teeth of a storm that you think is going to take you down. That is where you will find the God of history. Only in the middle of that storm. What a concept. And so maybe it's not such a mystery why Jesus has to be a little adversarial with his disciples. Because who wants to hear that? Aren't we much more comfortable with a religion where God is in our pocket? And God is at our altar? Because after all, we can control that door opening and closing in that church. It's relatively safe in there. And believe me, friends, it's a tough time these days, don't you think? It's hard times out there, and it's no wonder that people are coming to church to get away from it. It is no wonder that people are coming to church, as well as coming to every other kind of six different kind of religious movement, because they just want a refuge from the world. I feel a lot of empathy for that, because I feel that way a lot myself. That's okay, you know. It's okay to want a refuge. After all, that's why we're all here. But believe it, friends, in this story, God most assuredly shows up when we are in movement on a journey to the other side. As for whether God shows up in church or not, I don't know. Because, quite frankly, most of the time in the biblical story, God is not where folks are trying to house God. Now, the nice thing about these stories, as we've alluded to time and time again throughout the week, is that the disciples don't get it either. For they did not understand about the loaves because their hearts were hardened. Hearts were hardened. I've heard that phrase before.
Pharaoh's heart.
It is easier to get the people out of Egypt than to get Pharaoh's heart to soften in me. This is a very interesting moment in Mark's gospel because, turn for a minute to chapter 3. Jesus has just finished his first ministry tour around Capernaum upon the northwest side of the lake. And he has argued with the scribes about the debt system, and he's argued with the Pharisees about Sabbath economics, and he has argued with the priests about the purity system. In other words, he's taken on just about every political party there is, questioning whether their vision of society is faithful to the story. And it ends up, the ministry tour started out with an exorcism in a synagogue in chapter 1, and now it ends up with Jesus right back in church on Sunday. And he stands up before his own people, I'm reading from Mark chapter 3, verse 4, and he looks at all of them, and he says, "Is it lawful to do good or to do harm on the Sabbath? To save life or to kill?" What's that from? Now there's an echo of the old story. Don't you remember that moment when the people have been wandering in the wilderness for 40 years and they get right up there on Mount Nebo and they're overlooking the promised land and Moses brings everybody up and they enjoy the view, and then he says, listen up, people. We're going to get there. I know, children, we're going to get there. I may not get there with you, but I can see the promised land. And he says, so therefore, remember this. It's all about life. You will always, as a people, have a choice before you of life and death. Choose life. Deuteronomy 30. Choose life. That's what we are about as a people. And so Jesus reenacts that story, revises that story, re-narrates that story in the Capernaum synagogue, where everybody's gathered, and he's got the man with a withered hand, and he looks out and he says, here we are again. We've got this basic choice. Just like Martin King did at the Lincoln Memorial in 1963, here we are again. We got this choice before us. There's just one story, and we just have to keep retelling it and retelling it and retelling it. The great tragedy, the great tragic turning point, very early on in the Gospel of Mark, is that Mark, the narrator, tells us, and they were silent. And Jesus looks out at his own people, and his diagnosis is immediate. Where am I? He's thinking to himself. Where are we? What's his diagnosis?
Hardening of the arteries.
If their hearts are hard, where are the people? Egypt. They're right back in Egypt. And using the strongest possible language in Greek, Mark tells us, and Jesus was furious! Because this whole story is about trying to head out of Egypt, and here we are right back in Egypt. Well, you see, when you're a movement and you make that diagnosis, well, then you start trying to work at it and work at it and work at it. You try to develop some alternatives, and you try to work for church renewal, and you speak prophetically to the church, and you try to get people on the road back out of Egypt. But the problem is, when you're doing that kind of work, you start to get a little self-righteous. And you start thinking that you're a little bit holier than them. So when the disciples are in the boat, in their first little baby steps on their own, Mark wants to remind us in no uncertain terms that they too carry Pharaoh's disease. And if they carry it, then you can bet the farm that we carry it. Because that's part of the human condition. Their hearts were hardened because they didn't understand this mystery of the loaves. That's typical Markan narration. He'll just throw this stuff out, you know, just kind of tweak us with it, and we're all, yeah, mystery of the loaves, right. I knew that. Take a pause here for a moment, and let's talk about the narrative strategy of the Gospel writer Mark. There's a popular theater practitioner in Latin America by the name of Augusto Boal. He is to theater what Paulo Freire was to pedagogy. You know, some of you know Freire's work in popular pedagogy, who really believed that the way to teach people literacy was to begin with people's own experience, to have people learn to read not the text of someone else's life, but to learn to read the text of their own life. There's been a lot of that kind of literacy going on this week, I've noticed at Holden. There are folks who are trying to read the inner life. There are people who are trying to read cups of coffee and make sense of society by reading these things. They're in some of these nature walks, ecological literacy, people trying to read nature. There's lots of texts that we need to learn how to read. And unfortunately, when we go to school, a lot of what we read is just texts by academics for academics, and they tell us about a world that seems very distant and remote, which is why some of us fall asleep in these kinds of things. Very pathetic, Brother Cliff. You see, because if you're working from your own experience, you're not going to fall asleep, because that's your own experience. That's the stuff of your life, and you have a stake in making sense of it. So anyway, this is what Paulo Freire did in the field of literacy, and about a decade later, this guy Boal came up, and he was working with theater, and he noticed that, kind of like the classroom, the theater is the same format, kind of like this. There's the performer up here, and there's the spectators, and the gulf between them tends to be rather wide. Unless you go to the Rocky Horror Picture Show, which is popular theater. It's where you know the story so well that you get on your garter belt and your, what you call fishnet stockings, if you're a guy, and you jump up on stage. Young folks, tell the old folks about the Rocky Horror Picture Show after this. And you jump up on stage, and as the movie is showing behind you, you're acting it out. So what Boal did is he tried to work, again, with poor people, with peasants, to try to get them to move from being spectators to being spectators, those who see and who are so compelled by the story that they jump into it and become part of it. That is what the gospel writer of Mark is trying to do with us. He's trying to yank our sorry butts into this story. So we will stop being spectators and start getting with the program and being disciples. That's why the disciples in this story are so much like us. Because it reduces the distance between us and them. Now, in Hollywood today, the narrative strategy, most of the time, I believe, is to maximize the distance between spectator and performer. That's why not too many of us can really relate in our bodies to Arnold Schwarzenegger or Julia Roberts, or Denzel Washington, or whoever it's going to be. These people are bigger than life. That's the whole project of Hollywood, is to make these things, these people, these narratives bigger than life. That's why most of contemporary narrative on the screen, the small screen and the big screen, is about fabulous special effects and fabulous costuming and fabulous looking people and really stupid predictable plots and really shallow characters. It's a bit what you were saying yesterday about image. Image is everything. And image is everything. And that's the devil, friends, because, see, image is idolatry. That's an old, old story there. It's called fetishism. It's believing that the image will give you life if you just worship it. It's the most ancient heresy known to the people of Israel. And the ban on idolatry in Israel was nothing more and nothing less than the exhortation, yo, people, somebody made this stuff. Somebody made up Arnold Schwarzenegger. Somebody produced these special effects. This is not real. Don't be mesmerized by it. This is the work of human hands. As the prophets put it, it can't see, it can't hear your cries, and it can't help you out. Fetishism. It is the number one religion in America today. Fetishism. The power of the product to transform my life. If I could just get the right deodorant, I know that my love life will improve. You see, it's as stupid today as it was with the golden calf. But it plays big time. How did I get off on that? No idea. Except that these stories are, this is populist narratives. This is stuff that wants you to be part of it. It's like the talent show last night. It's like the open mic forum. It's come and be part of it. Jump up on stage. Show us what you got. Let's all be a community reading this story together and then having this story read us and empower us to tell it one more time in our bodies, in the world. So the narrative strategy of Mark is to try to reduce that distance between reader and text, between audience and story. And there is one more boat story yet that's going to close the deal. Turn to chapter 8. Here's where school is out. And before school is out, what do you have? You got finals. Wherever we left off, we were upstairs there. Y'all want to, Pat, you want to start and read real loud so that Radio Land can hear this. Chapter 8, verse 14, start in verse 13 and read through verse 21, please.
Then he left them. He again got into a boat and crossed over to the other side of the lake.
The disciples had forgotten to bring any bread, and they had only one loaf with them in the boat.
I'll let you go.
And he cautioned them, saying, "Watch out. Be aware of the yeast of the Pharisees and the yeast of Herod."
They said to one another, "It is because we have no bread."
Aware of their discussion, Jesus asked them, "Why are you talking about having no bread? Do you still not see or understand? Are your hearts hardened?
Do you have eyes and fail to see? Do you have ears and fail to hear? And do you not remember?" "When I broke the 5 loaves among 5,000, how many baskets full of fragments did you take up?" They said unto him, 12.
"And the 7 of the 4,000, how many baskets full of broken pieces did you collect?" And they said to him, 7.
And he said to them, "Do you not yet understand?"
And we're reading along and we're... "Do you not yet understand?" Understand what? Did anybody feel that when you heard that text? What are these people talking about? Come on, how many of you felt that? Raise your hand. All right, those of you who didn't raise your hand, tell me what it's about. Is there enough? What is the mystery of the loaves? You tell me. You do the arithmetic. What does this mean, this 12 and this 7? Well, friends, if you're feeling perplexed here, then Mark has got you right where he wants you. He has yanked you into the story because now the distance between you and the disciples is nil. That's right. You're in the boat. And that is exactly the narrative strategy. This is exactly the midway point in the Gospel of Mark. And it's about to, they're about to, when they disembark, they're going to leave the boat behind for the rest of the story, and they're going to depart in a new direction. Long march to Jerusalem and the Passion story. And so what Mark is doing here is he's throwing up a big red light. And he's saying, all right, pop quiz. Here's what we've done today. Did this feeding, how many loaves left over?
7.
How many loaves left over? And we did this other feeding, and how many loaves left over?
Six.
Six. This is good. This is the real world. What does it all mean? If we really don't understand this conversation in this boat, if we don't pass the test in school, what do we have to do? We got to take it again, which means we got to go back and reread the story and keep rereading the story and keep rereading the story until we begin to get it. Turn to Deuteronomy chapter 29. This is the preface to the moment we were alluding to just a couple of minutes ago of Moses gathering everybody on the mountain to review. Deuteronomy chapter 29. Someone read just verses 3 through 3 and 4. Verses 2 to 4. Deuteronomy 29, verses 2 to 4.
And Moses summoned all Israel and said to them, "You have seen all that the Lord did before your eyes in the land of Egypt, to Pharaoh and to all his servants and to all his land, the great trials which your eyes saw, the signs and those great wonders. But to this day the Lord has not given you a mind to understand, or eyes to see, or ears to hear."
Well, there you are. You see, in the end, folks, whatever else you say about your religion, whatever catechism you learn, whatever theological doctrine you know, all it really comes down to is whether you have eyes to see and ears to hear and a heart to feel. Anything strike you about this little vignette? What does this have to do with baptism? What do you do when you're fixing to get baptized? At least as an adult. We won't get into the infant baptism thing here, not with you Lutherans. I'm not going there. But let's say you're an adult or a young adult and you're about to be baptized, and what's the formation? There's a catechism. And what's the traditional form of catechism?
Question.
That's right. It's being asked questions. Now, admittedly, there's the kind of dull and boring form of asking questions in which they're rhetorical questions, or they're questions which have one right answer and you'd better memorize it in time to get baptized. That's one form of questioning, isn't it? But that's not the only form of questioning there is. There are the deeper questions which we can ask each other, which is all the baptismal catechism really is. It's some Christians asking questions of other Christians. Questions which presumably the asker also lives under. Just like the Bible study leader lives under these stories. Those questions are meant to invite us to deep reflection on whether we understand this story yet. I think. Isn't it? You want to come be part of this community? That's a good thing. How much of the story do you understand? Which is a very sophisticated way of saying, do you know what you're getting into here? You see, is baptism, friends, about punching in the right code to get in the door? Know the code. Or is baptism the community saying to its new members, you know, friend, we're on a journey. And it's a risky journey. Truth in advertising. It is not an easy journey. We're going to go through waters, and we're going to go under waters, and we're going to go through fire. And we're going to be venturing out into territory that's scary for us. Do you want to be a part of this story? If so, if you can answer yes to those questions, a yes that comes out of a real sense of having wrestled with these stories, then sister, brother, pull up a chair by the campfire. Do you get it yet? Do you have eyes to see? Do you have ears to hear? And how about that heart? Is it still Pharaoh's heart? And do you remember? That's the great Deuteronomic question. Do you remember? This is the point in which the story we're reading and the story we're living has to interface. We're going to have to figure out if we will always be spectators or whether at some point we are going to jump in and allow this story to read us so that our trials and tribulations, our perplexities, our sadnesses, our disappointments, our apostasy can be read by the script of this story. This story, which is really just an old story about going through the waters and being taken on a boat over the waters. When you're ready to let this story begin to read your story, then I believe you're a candidate for baptism. And the questions are questions the entire community stands under. Do we get it yet? Of course, we never totally get it. Probably the fact of the matter is we don't get very much of it at all. Which is why, as we said yesterday, the great primal symbol of the church is a boat on the waters. And the waters are stormy, and the wind is howling. And here in the boat, we're just trying to figure out if we understand the story. We can't understand the story if we're not taking that journey. Can't do it. We cannot, in the church, be part of this story as spectators. Let me say that again. We cannot be part of this story as spectators. In synagogue, they know something about this. There is a more robust sense of story among our Jewish sisters and brothers. And there is a little known feast in the synagogue, at least little known to Christians, called Simchat Torah. Some of you know it? Mm-hmm. I was exposed to it for the first time last year, when I was visiting some friends up in Oakland, and they took me to synagogue, and to my extreme good fortune, and I'm sure to the plan of God for my life, it was the Feast of Simchat Torah. And this feast happens at the end of what the synagogue would call the end of its lectionary cycle. They've gone through the readings, because they're on lectionary, just like Christians are on lectionary, and they read from Torah, and read from the prophets, and read from the writings. And at the end of the cycle, they literally roll back the scroll, right, because Torah is a scroll. They roll back the scroll to the beginning to begin the cycle again. You see, which is a perfect metaphor for all we ought to do when we meet together, is just roll it back and read the story again and keep reading the story again until it starts to read us. But what they do in celebration of the rolling back of the scroll was the most profound religious experience I've ever had in a house of worship, bar none. And maybe it's just me. But what they do is they take the scrolls, right, out of the, what's this called?
Ark.
It's called the Ark.
Yep.
Take the scrolls out. And there might be one scroll, and there might be many scrolls, depending on the synagogue. And it's not just the rabbi, but regular folks stand up, and they're hugging the scrolls like this. And then all the congregation gets up, and they start dancing. Oh, I'm sorry. That's good religion, people. They're dancing around the story because they know their lives depend on it. And it's that great, at least at this synagogue, it's that great Ashkenazi thing, you know. And everybody's dancing and dancing and dancing around the scrolls, and people in the middle are dancing. And everybody's dancing around the story. And then they roll back the scroll and they start again. I don't know why we go to church. I'm like the disciples. I don't understand the mystery. I don't get a lot of the stuff we do in church. But I understand this, and I understand this. See, my handicap is I didn't grow up in church, so I just got grafted into the story along the way, and it somewhere along the line it started to read me, and I can't get away from it. But one thing I do understand that we do in church is we read the story. And I believe, friends, as long as we read this story in church and read it as if our lives depended on it, and every once in a while dance around it as if our lives depended on it, then there will always be the possibility that we will have eyes to see and ears to hear and a heart that will not be Pharaoh's heart. And insofar as that is true, then I believe our practice in the world will follow. Leslie Silko. I cited her yesterday, and I want to cite her again. And in order to do that, I think we need to stand up and hold hands and be in that circle. Oh, as for the mystery of the loaves, homework. Her novel Ceremony, Leslie Silko puts these words in the mouth of an elder. Let me tell you something about stories. They are not just entertainment. Don't be fooled. Stories are all we have. All we have to protect us from illness and death. The evil is mighty, but it cannot stand up to our stories. So they would like us to forget our stories or become confused about our stories. They would like that because then we would be defenseless. So we keep them right in our belly. Right here. And as the stories go on, the ceremony may continue and the celebration may commence. Thanks for being around the circle, being around the story. It's been good to be here at Holden Village this week. Go in peace.